Well, I appreciate having the opportunity to visit with you this morning for your worship time. This is a little bit of an unusual message to give on a Sunday morning. I've never given this particular one on a Sunday morning, but Lloyd said that he had promised you that's what I was going to talk on, so I didn't have any choice. I've enjoyed being here this weekend with Lloyd and Doris and at the Seven Wonders Museum. Several of you, I think, came down yesterday. How many of you came to the museum this weekend? Oh, nobody in here. Okay, good. Well, you get to hear a new message then. At any rate, we've known Lloyd and Doris for probably 15 years now. The Institute for Creation Research, who I work for, have had tours here to Mount St. Helens over the years. In fact, we quit having them for quite a while because the Seven Wonders Museum and the people associated with it were doing the tours very nicely, and we didn't need to do it. But we tried to come back one more time to do a tour about 4 years ago, and we've had troubles in the past where when we've had tours here, it rains on the mountain and you can't get up there, or if you do, you're going to get washed off the mountain. Well, that last one 4 years ago, we had the same thing happen. The day we were supposed to go up on the mountain, it rained so hard we couldn't go. So as our alternative, we went over to the caves on the south side, Ape Cave, and went through. We didn't get wet, but we didn't get to see the top of the mountain, unfortunately. But it was still a good tour. We really enjoyed that. This is a beautiful area, and I've always enjoyed coming here. I now live up on Camino Island north of Seattle with a view of Whidbey Island across the sound. It's a beautiful place there, too. But this is kind of a special area. I, from my own personal experience, remember it from the time the mountain erupted. You saw it firsthand. I got to see it at the same time, but I was in near Sacramento, California, running a cloud physics research experiment on trying to increase snow on the mountains up near Lake Tahoe. And we had a satellite output where we had pictures every 30 minutes to see what was going on. And all of a sudden, on a Sunday morning, May the 18th, when I was the director of the program, there was this big donut showed up on the southwest part of Washington State. And this big donut-shaped cloud, I had no idea what that was. Well, I was busy running the project, but it then kind of turned into a bigger donut and a bigger donut and then formed a kind of a plume that flowed out over eastern Washington. Well, we didn't know until that afternoon what was going on. We had never seen anything like that. Of course, Mount St. Helens erupted. So I got to see it a little further and a safer distance than you did. I don't think I would have wanted to live in Tootle like you all do when the mud flows started coming down the river. That would have scared me. How much warning did you have? Were you able to get out that Sunday afternoon to avoid it? You got enough warning to get away? How much?
I got out by helicopter.
You got out by helicopter. I don't think I want to live. Tootle is a beautiful place now. In fact, my wife and I just drove up the canyon before the services this morning for about 15 minutes to see what it looks like. It looks a lot different now. It's beautiful again. But boy, I remember being up here right after it happened, and it wasn't beautiful in many places. By the way, this is my wife Jeanette over here. She and our little dog Buttons have came down for the weekend. So anyway, we're getting out a little bit from time to time. I don't travel as much as I used to. Wanted to talk with you today a topic that I'm calling Some Like It Hot. Most of you my age or older, you remember the old Marilyn Monroe movie, Some Like It Hot. The younger people don't know about that, but I thought it was kind of a neat title to talk about global warming. We talked about this yesterday afternoon, and I think I spent probably 2 hours on this topic. Are you ready for a two-hour lecture? No, we're going to keep it down to about 30, 35, 40 minutes maybe. Any rate, this topic is very interesting to Christians in particular in our world in general. As you well know, as Lloyd introduced, the world is very concerned about global warming. They fear that man in the burning of fossil fuels and the release of carbon dioxide have caused a climate change, and they're very concerned about that because they have misinterpreted the geologic record. They believe that the Earth has been around for billions of years. So when they look at the ice ages, they see multiple ice ages. What we find from Scripture is that there was a major catastrophe, which we call the Genesis flood, some 4,500 years ago or so. That flood had much more energy than just simply it rained for 40 days and 40 nights and the water came up and then went down gently. It destroyed the whole surface of the earth. The continents broke apart. Thousands of volcanoes erupted. All the forests were completely destroyed, and the whole earth was changed. But one of the really interesting things is on the bottom of the ocean, there's what's called the mid-ocean ridge. And that ridge is some 40,000 miles long. It runs down between North and South America, down around the tip of Africa, over into the Indian Ocean, around south of Australia, and back up into the Pacific Ocean. When that ridge developed, which is made out of lava and magma, some of which came out of Mount St. Helens and other places, when that happened, it heated the oceans as much as 86 degrees Fahrenheit, or some have estimated as much as 120 degrees Fahrenheit. You've probably heard of the El Nino. When the ocean is warmer by 1 or 2 or 3 degrees in about every 7 to 10 years in the Pacific Ocean, it causes more rain and storminess all across the United States, particularly here on the West Coast. Can you imagine what it would be like if the whole ocean was warm, like as I'm suggesting? Not just 1 or 2 degrees, but tens of degrees. Well, that changed the climate dramatically. And if we believe that happened in a relatively short period of time, rather than over hundreds of thousands of years and millions of years, the energy that was released by that mid-ocean ridge would have warmed the ocean and changed the climate very dramatically. The conventional world believes that that ridge occurred over some 65 million years, and the heat was released extremely slowly, and it didn't change the climate. They're trying to understand the kind of climate change that we understand was catastrophic. They are trying to explain it in a very gentle, gradual way, and they're concerned that our atmosphere and climate is very unstable, and they're afraid that if a little bit of pollution is put into the atmosphere, it's going to change it so dramatically it could lead to warming and then sudden cooling, possibly another ice age. Well, if we understand that the history of the earth is based upon what the events of the Genesis flood, then we don't have to worry about it, because that was such a gigantic event, a catastrophic event, that it caused these processes. And then the ocean warmed, cooled off, and our climate settled into the climate we have today. It would have taken that kind of a catastrophic process to produce the climate changes we've seen in history. So that's the difference between our view. We see the atmosphere as very stable. They see it as very unstable, and any little change could lead to all kinds of problems. So let's see whether, in fact, global warming is occurring. And by the way, I need to forewarn you, I believe global warming is occurring, but it's on the order of 1 or 2 degrees, and it's probably not caused mostly by man right now. We may contribute a slight amount to it, but I believe there's other reasons which I want to go into this morning. Now, the reason this is important to Christians is we're kind of whipsawed in this whole discussion. We don't know who to believe. We don't know whether we have to worry about the end of this world as we know it and all the global warming that's going to come with it and the destruction of vegetation and pollution and all this. And as Christians, we know that God has charged us to be stewards of this world. Yet at the same time, he gave us a mandate. It's called the dominion mandate. You find in Genesis 1:26, where it says, God provided this world for us to be able to use. Now the question is, how much should you use it, and how do you avoid abusing it? There are some who would say, I don't care what happens. I'm going to get my money out of it. I'm going to cut the forest down completely. And I know that's a sensitive topic to many of you in this room. Others would say, no, we can't do anything. We've got to leave the trees as they were. And if, in fact, they've already been cut down, they've got to replant them and get it back the way it was before the white man ever showed up on the West Coast. Well, I believe that both of those extremes are wrong. I believe that God gave us a mandate to use it but not abuse it. Now, that becomes kind of an interesting issue, how to deal with that. And particularly in the atmosphere and global warming, how do we deal with that? Another concern that Christians have is the warming that we think is going on and everybody talks about, is that an initial sign of the Lord's return? We know from prophecy that that God is going to come back and judge this world by fire. Well, fire produces warmth, doesn't it? Heating. Is this global warming that's going on? Is this kind of a warning? Are we ready for the end times? Is the Lord going to come back tomorrow because of this? Have we got just a little bit hint of that? Obviously, we believe the Lord is going to come back soon. He said we can't know the day and the hour, but we can know the season. Is this the season? Well, I don't believe global warming is a sign, but that doesn't mean the Lord isn't coming back. So let's get into this a little bit. It's a very interesting topic. I hope this helps as we go through this today. First of all, a number of years ago, about 10 years ago, I had an opportunity to study this in depth, and I'm going to report a little bit of how I went about this analysis. First of all, there was a laboratory established over in the Big Island of Hawaii, on Mauna Loa. You know, there's two volcanoes on the Big Island of Hawaii. One is Mauna Kea, where the telescopes are located, and one is Mauna Loa, which is on the southwest corner of the island, where measurements of gases in the atmosphere and other meteorological measurements are made. Well, my son-in-law was in the Navy about 10 years ago. He was on a missile cruiser, and he invited me to go meet him in Hawaii and come back to San Diego on the ship on what's called a Tiger Cruise. Family and relatives are sometimes invited by Navy people to be able to do that last leg back home. So I went and did that. But I decided if I'm going to go to Hawaii, this would be a great opportunity to go out and visit the laboratory on the island of Big Island of Hawaii to visit that, because it was established in 1958. And a fellow by the name of Roger Revell, who was the founder and chancellor of the University of California at San Diego, had the idea that the knowledge of about how much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere may likely be a very important thing to know. So he set up, he asked a fellow by the name of Keeling, who was a new employee of his at the university there, to go to the Big Island and set up this laboratory and start measuring carbon dioxide. And they started that in 1958, and I went to visit that laboratory. Okay, let's see if not getting any. Do I have to point it at anything, or is it supposed to work?
It goes to sleep for a couple seconds. You got to anticipate after you talk along.
Okay. You want to go and hit the forward deal? Okay. This is a picture of the Mauna Loa Observatory. That actually is Mauna Kea off in the distance. The Mauna Loa is behind us there. But that's a laboratory, and I went over to see the laboratory, and it turns out one of my buddies from graduate school actually ran the laboratory, so that was kind of a nice thing to do. But I decided I was going to look at the carbon dioxide. Well, it's still not going to go for me. I guess we'll just have to have you do it. Go ahead and progress. Okay, this is a plot of the carbon dioxide concentration measured at Mauna Loa. This, down on the bottom axis here is the time from 1958 actually to 2007, which is where I plotted the data. On the vertical axis is the concentration of carbon dioxide in parts per million. That means that there's one molecule of carbon dioxide for a million molecules of air in general. But the thing that's important, it's interesting to see, is back in 1958, it was around 315 parts per million. I know this is a little bit more science than you probably want, but you need to understand it's been increasing and going up to now over 380, actually approaching 400 parts per million today, which means that the carbon dioxide over that last 30 years has been going up. And that's a direct measurement. There's no question but what that has happened. Now, the reason the lab was built out in Hawaii was because it's out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and it's not influenced by industrial and cars and all that sort of thing out in the middle of the ocean, at least very little. And so you're able to get a measure of what the general concentration in the whole atmosphere is without contamination. So there's no question what carbon dioxide is going up. One of the things that you may wonder about, though, is what are these little wiggles here? And believe it or not, the concentration of carbon dioxide varies each year. In the wintertime, the concentration of carbon dioxide is higher, and in the summer, it's lower. So at the top part of this curve is in the wintertime, and the bottom part is in the summer. And the reason for that is, in the wintertime, the vegetation in the ocean and on the continents dies off because of the cold weather. It releases carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. In the summertime, as the grass grows and the flowers grow, and in the ocean, the various vegetation grows there, it absorbs carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. So it goes down a little bit. So you see that fluctuation. Now, this is important because Dr. Revell had about 8 to 10 years of data when he taught a class at Harvard University, and he told his students about this measurement and how significant it appeared it was likely to be. One of the students in his class was taking just a short course. His name was Al Gore. And he was impressed with Dr. Revell because he's a world-class scientist. In fact, I've talked to him, and he was a very nice gentleman. I enjoyed talking with him. But Dr. Revell said something. He says, "This is a really interesting feature. It's almost like the earth is breathing." Isn't that an interesting thought? Well, actually, Al Gore picked up on that, and that kind of became the motive for him getting so involved in global warming. And in a sense, although Al Gore, his family, I believe it's Tennessee or Kentucky, wherever his family was from, they had Christian background. However, Al Gore was kind of a marginal Christian, maybe he is today, I don't know. But it kind of gave him a leaning toward pantheism. That is, that the earth itself almost has godlike characteristics. And he picked that up from this, and it's kind of been driving him ever since. Okay, well, there's no question carbon dioxide has been increasing, and it continues to do so today. And it's probably a lot to do with the burning of fossil fuels. Fossil fuels are anything like coal and oil, natural gas, anything that's been buried and stored, and when you burn it, it puts out a lot more carbon dioxide because there's a lot of carbon dioxide in those fossil fuels. Anyway, at that point I decided, you know, I need to check this out because there was a lot of claims even 10 and 15 years ago about the concerns about global warming. There's a lot of data that's been collected, and it covers the whole globe. There's a lot of it, but I couldn't analyze all that data. There are thousands of scientists today analyzing that data, and they're looking into this problem over the thousands of observing stations all over the globe. I can't do that. So I decided I have to be selective and just pick a few stations here and there and see if, without any bias and selection, whether there's any indication that there might be global warming in those data. And, of course, I only had a small computer at the time that I could do that with. We have even very large computers now at the institute where I work, but we didn't have those at the time. So I was limited on how much I could do. So I selected three issues. Next slide. The first one I selected had to do with the surface temperature, sea surface temperature. And it turned out back about 35, 40 years ago, the Weather Service, which is called NOAA, not N-O-A-H, but N-O-A-A for Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. That's it. National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA. At any rate, they put out a bunch of these buoys out over the ocean, and on these buoys, they were able to measure air temperature, they were able to measure winds, precipitation, and they had temperatures down under the ocean, right at the surface and down at deeper levels. So I decided to get some data from one of these buoys out in the ocean. Next slide. And here's a distribution of these buoys. This is up in the Gulf of Alaska. Here's Kodiak Island. And I selected one right here, number 46001. And the reason I selected it was because it's in a region that has a lot of change in temperature between the winter and summer. But it normally doesn't get ice on the surface of the ocean there because that would affect the quality of the data I could get. Plus, that particular buoy had been there one of the longest out there. There's lots of them out there now in the Pacific Ocean, the Gulf of Alaska, even up in the Arctic, and over in the Atlantic Ocean, all around the globe now. But they've only been put in fairly recently, so the data has not been taken over a long enough period of time. But that one, at the time I analyzed the data, was over 30 years. And so that was a reasonably good sample. Here's the data that I got. Take the next slide. This is, again, along the horizontal axis of the time from about 1977 up to 2007. So there's about a 30-year period there. This is the sea surface temperature in degrees centigrade. Now, I know that's a scientific unit. It's about each centigrade degree is like 2 degrees Fahrenheit. And the freezing point is at 0 degrees centigrade, which is right down here at the bottom. But you'll notice that in the wintertime, the temperature was down around 3 degrees centigrade, just above the freezing point. And at the summer, it would get up around 15, 16 degrees centigrade, much warmer. But and there's a lot of data here. I mean, we're talking, the data was taken one data point every second, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year for 30 years. I collected enough data from this one buoy to completely bog down my computer. It almost crippled it. At any rate, the key is you can look at that data, and it's got a lot of noise, and it's kind of hard to see if there's anything going on. But there's a technique, a scientific technique for giving you a little better trend that's not so complicated. It's called the least squares fit to all that data. And that's what this line shows. It's a line that starts back there in 1977, about 7.5 degrees centigrade, increasing over 30 years up to about 10 degrees centigrade. So that's about 1.5 degrees, or about 3 degrees Fahrenheit increase in 30 years. So the first thing I found was there is, at least for that period of time, an indication of a slight increase in temperature. Well, okay, that was one item. I got one hint. Let's try a couple more, the second one, the next slide. So I decided to look at hurricanes that come and hit the United States down in the southeast. Now, the reason I picked this, I was interested in hurricanes anyway. I was doing modeling of hurricanes. It turns out there's a relationship between the sea surface temperature and hurricane frequency and intensity. If you have a hotter temperature, sea surface temperature, you get more hurricanes, and they're stronger, and they get bigger, and they last longer. Well, I decided to just look at one of those, and that is how many of them were there. This is actually not hurricanes, but tropical storms I'm going to look at the next slide. These are like hurricanes. Go ahead and that have a sustained wind of over 39 miles per hour. Well, it turns out we can look at those very nicely. This, again, is the time from about 1850 to about 2007. We can look at those today with satellites and very clearly see them and count them and so on. But believe it or not, there's data that go all the way back to 1850. So we know how many hurricanes, or in this case tropical storms, hit the southern United States and the Gulf of Mexico and Florida and up the East Coast back as far as 1850. Now, we didn't have the observations as good as we have today, but there was a lot of ships that were sailing ships, steamships, and so on, that they were able to keep track of these because they wanted to avoid them. But you'll notice the interesting thing. Here is zero per year. This is the number of storms per year, tropical storms, and 5, 10, 15, 20. We've got some years in which the number of storms has exceeded 20. In fact, in 2005, there was 27 hurricanes or tropical storms that came into the southeast. But it's a very noisy set of data. There are periods of time when and again, we put this least squares fit line through the data, and it shows that the numbers increase from about 6 per year back in 1850 or so about to about 15 here in about 2007. It more than doubled in that 150 years. Now, we have to be a little careful with that interpretation because we didn't have satellite observations back here, so it's likely that these numbers back here are biased to a smaller number. It's probable that there were more back here than we were able to see. We don't know exactly how many more, but this would be probably the greatest increase in numbers of tropical storms that you would estimate. But you'll notice an interesting thing here. Near the end, the numbers have been increasing more strongly than during the other period, although there are periods in here when there's all kinds of noise. Okay, well, that again is a second hint there may be some warming. Okay, let's look at a third example. This is the coverage, ice cover pack in the Arctic Ocean up near the North Pole. This is looking down on the North Pole. The North Pole is about here, and this white area was the cover of ice in 2006, and this is done by satellite. We couldn't really do this until we had satellite coverage for the last 30 years. Prior to that, all you could do was send up a dog sled and run around on the ice pack, and it would take you forever. You know how long it took some of the explorers to get to the North Pole and back? Some of them didn't even make it. So you couldn't have done it before satellite. But here's an indication that has been decreasing. You notice the kind of a purple line running around outside that white area? That was the cover in the summertime of the year 2000. So from 2000, it reduced in coverage from that purple line to the white area. Now, the reason we do that in the summer is in the winter, it's frozen over completely. The whole thing is solid ice. But in the summertime, it is melted, and in the years when it's warmer, you will have more melting. And that's why Al Gore talks about, the ice pack is melting and all the polar bears are going to die. Well, it turns out the polar bear argument is completely fake, false. It turns out in the last 20 years, the number of polar bears has actually doubled, going in the wrong way from that idea. So we don't need to worry about the polar bears. They don't have to have ice to stand on. They can escape out and make it okay. If they got stuck out in the middle at the North Pole and the whole thing disappeared, yes, they'd be in trouble. But as that thing is melting back, there's still ice there, and they can get off before it melts completely. Even if it goes away completely, it'll be harder for them, but they can still make it. Okay, well, I've got to get the data. Next slide. Okay, so this is the data, actually, for the aerial coverage of the ice pack for the last 30 years. From, again, 1977 to 2007. This is the area in units of millions of square kilometers. Don't worry about that unit. But in the summertime, the area is very small. This would be the aerial coverage of the ice pack in the summer. This would be in the winter. And, of course, in the summer when it's warmer, it's going to melt, so it would be a smaller area. But if you do, again, that least squares fit, you'll see that it started out back in 1977 about 12 million square kilometers, and it declined with time to 2007 down to about 10.5 million. So there's a decrease. Now, you would expect a decrease in this case because if the ocean is getting warmer, there would be less ice. So the coverage should go down. So based on this, the studies that I did personally in a limited data set over a limited period of time, there are hints that the globe appears to be warming. Now, it's a relatively small amount. That's actually not all that small, but you have to qualify it in that it could fluctuate. It could go back the other way for a while, or the limited place I selected the data may do a certain thing, and then someplace else it might do something different. So to do a complete analysis, you have to analyze all of it, and a lot of your tax dollars being spent doing that kind of analysis. So first of all, we have a hint. Yes, there is some warming. Now, is that important, and is man responsible for it? That's the next question. Next slide. Okay, here is another measure that's been done using the weather stations all over the northern hemisphere. You know, the standard little white box with the louvered sides on it that has temperature gauges and relative humidity. Actually, it's a dew point temperature that you get relative humidity from. And that's measured all day long over hundreds and actually thousands of weather stations all over the northern hemisphere, pulling all that data together for the last, in this case, since about 1880. And by the way, these are actual measurements of temperature, not estimates based on what are called proxy variables, which is what you have to use if you're going to go back 1,000 years or something. Actual direct measurements with thermometers in here. This data shows for the last 100 years or a little more that the temperature, and I need to say something else. Again, this is time from 1880 to 2007 or so. This is not actual temperature. It's a temperature difference. Now, this is confusing, but this is the way scientists tend to work. They took an average temperature from about 1960 to 1980, calculated what the average temperature at that point was, and then calculated what the difference in the past has been relative to that or up to the current time. So the zero line, this would be the actual temperature, average temperature 1860 to 1880, the zero line. Prior to about 1940, the temperature was cooler than that average temperature, and after about 1940, it was warmer. However, you notice an interesting feature right in here. There's a period from 1940 to 1970, approximately, in which prior to that, the temperature was increasing. And from about 1940 to 1970, it was decreasing, and then it started increasing again. Now, the conventional explanation for global warming is it's caused by burning of fossil fuels, which really took off after the Second World War. or right at and after the Second World War. We really started going into the industrialization of this country, building all kinds of cars, lots of factories going on, putting out all kinds of pollution with carbon dioxide in it. You would expect if global warming was caused simply by carbon dioxide, it would just continue to go right on up, not have this hiatus in it or a decrease. And so during this period, the scientific community wasn't talking about global warming. They were talking about global cooling. And they were concerned that we were approaching another ice age. I went to graduate school in 1970 to 1974, and the first thing I did, and my degree is in atmospheric science from Colorado State University, when I went to school, all my professors were talking about another ice age is coming. What are we going to do about it? Well, that turned around after that. Of course, in 1970, it hadn't obviously turned around yet, so it was another 10 years before they began to get really concerned. But some of the people were so concerned, they were proposing methods to stop the ice age from coming. One I particularly remember was that there were several scientists who were getting government contracts to work with the Air Force to fill C-141s with carbon black and dump that carbon black on the North Pole and the South Pole to melt the snow so it would warm up. Now, I thought that was a stupid idea. I mean, it does work in small areas if you have any kind of material, you know, dust and dirt and so on that's on top of snow. It will cause the heating to occur and melt the ice more quickly. But to do that over the whole North Pole, I mean, that's really beyond reason. Well, by about 1980 or so, they decided, no, the ice age is not coming. It's going to start warming. And then ever since then, we've had warming. Okay, let's continue to the next slide. Now, I need to tell you that there is a problem with temperature measurements from the weather stations, because there is a built-in bias toward warming with time in the weather data that's collected, and this is not taken into account when they do the analysis. For example, 100 years ago, when the Weather Service put in these little weather stations, they were most of them, or many of them, were out in the country. They weren't near any buildings. They weren't in a town. Ones that were in small towns, over 100 years, those towns grew into cities. We know there's something that's called the heat island effect. So that the temperature in a town is always going to be warmer, both during the daytime and the nighttime, because of all the concrete and the buildings and the roads. It absorbs the heat and then releases it. Particularly at night, the temperature stays warmer at night than it does in the daytime. So there's a bias toward the temperatures getting warmer with time. Now, some people have attempted to take that into account, but there's not been a good solution to that. So you have to be careful. A lot of the data that we think justifies global warming is caused simply because the observations were not taken properly. Next slide. Okay, here is a very controversial graph. How many of some of you may have heard of something called the hockey stick diagram. This is data that has been collected and analyzed for the last 100 years or so and extrapolated or extended back to 1,000 years back from today. That is actually the way a paleoclimatologist studies climate. I consider myself a paleoclimatologist. That's a person who studies old climate. Paleo means old. Climate or climatology is a study of climates. Well, the conventional scientific community has developed a graph here that indicates that the temperature has been uniform for the last 900 years or so, and for the last 100 years, suddenly has started going up. It looks kind of like a hockey stick, doesn't it? Well, there's a tremendous amount of controversy over that, and it turns out that the government has been using that as their primary estimate of what temperature has been historically for the last 1,000 years, but it was discovered about 2 years ago that the scientists who developed that cheated. They actually used a program that was designed to make the hockey stick diagram look like this, flat for a long time and then suddenly start to rise, because it allowed for a justification of global warming. Next slide. Historically, for a long time, in all the graduate classes I ever took, this was what the temperature trend was understood to be. Back about the same time, 1,000 years ago up to the current time, It was understood that there was a period from about 1,000 years ago to about 600 years ago at 1400 AD that it was warm, called the medieval optimum, that it was much warmer. This is when the Vikings settled Greenland. You remember that all the ice disappeared when the Vikings settled there, and then later it got cold and covered them up and ran them off, or maybe killed them, I don't know. But then there was a period from about 1400 up to about 1900 in which it was much colder. The cold means that the average temperature was below the normal temperature, and it occurred in here. It was called the Little Ice Age. There was a period of time where all the glaciers started getting more massive and moving down the mountain. The rivers would freeze over. Ice sheets would cover larger areas. And basically, the temperature was much colder than it is even today. And then starting around 1850 or 1900, the temperature started rising again. So there's an oscillation here that is built into the data. Next slide. Now, I need to bring back Al Gore here and tell you what he thinks are two very important issues, and tell you that there's some major problems with these. Now, you have to understand Al Gore is not a scientist, but he has tried to sell this idea of global warming, partly because he is legitimately concerned about the world surviving, and he has misinterpreted and led the scientific community to do their thing, and it's become a political football now. But more importantly than that, Al Gore gets a real major kickback from this whole process. He developed something like the stock market for selling and trading carbon dioxide credits. So if you got a factory that puts out a lot of carbon dioxide, the government would shut them down if they didn't have some way of adjusting for that. So they go find somebody that doesn't produce carbon dioxide, and they have credits that they can buy to offset the amount of carbon dioxide they put out. Al Gore gets a percentage of that. Every time you have credits trained, it's like a stock market. Al Gore gets money from that. So that's one of the reasons why there's such a resistance to doing away with the idea of global warming. Not only that, there is another motive. Scientists quite often want to get research money to be able to do their work. I'm a scientist too, and it really angers me, because if you want to get money today, all you got to do is mention global warming in your application to the government to get money, and they will fund your research. If you don't say anything about global warming, it's very unlikely you're going to get funded. So there's a self-benefit. And finally, there's another one. There's a number of people in our society and in our world that are one-worlders. They actually see global warming as the avenue to be able to build a one-world government. And they do this because the atmosphere is not bounded by political boundaries. You don't have to worry about just in the United States. The air flows over boundaries all the way around the globe. In fact, if you put up a helium balloon into the atmosphere up at about 20 or 30,000 feet and it floats there, it'll go all the way around the world and back again in about a week or 10 days. You can't control where the air goes. And so there's all kinds of studies. If you pollute here, it's going to pollute somebody else. You're probably very familiar with this argument that's going on right here in Kelso. You've heard the stories about the coal from Montana being shipped over by railroad cars to Kelso and being shipped to China. Well, the reason for that partly is China is really trying to grow and become industrialized, and they need all the coal they can get. But the environmentalists have stopped much of the use of coal, and they're continuing to try to shut it down. Shutting down coal production in Montana, people can't get rid of their coal, so here China comes along and says, we'll buy your coal. So they're going to ship it to Kelso and up near Cherry Point where I live, ship it to China. Well, the environmentalists are very unhappy about that because it does affect the area that the coal is shipped through. It produces jobs, which is a benefit, but it also has some pollution problems. But they're not happy that China is going to burn that over there, because when they release the carbon dioxide, it's going to come back to us. It's going to float back in the atmosphere. So they're going to try to stop that as well. Anyway, I thought I'd bring that in because it's affecting you right here locally. Okay, I'm just going to talk about this. I better keep moving. I'm doing pretty good. This is a graph that Al Gore has used to say that carbon dioxide causes global warming. This now is a reverse chart of the age. It goes from 600,000 years ago to zero. And you say, how do you measure temperature back there? You don't measure it directly. You measure something that is related to temperature that we can observe today, and then you extrapolate it back hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of years ago. That's called extrapolation, which scientifically is not very acceptable, but that's what's done because it's the best thing we can do. We don't have any other way of measuring it. But if we go from a long time ago to today and you plot such things as carbon dioxide concentration that they have estimates of in seafloor sediments and ice cores and other places, and temperature, you notice something very interesting. Where the carbon dioxide is high, the temperature is high. Each one of these peaks is related. Wherever the carbon dioxide is low, the temperature is relatively low. And each one of these are thought to be an ice age. This is a cold period of an ice age, and this is an ice age. This is an ice age, and so on. They believe that there was multiple ice ages about every 100,000 years apart. The importance of that is that Al Gore says, and this is true, there seems to be a very strong correlation between carbon dioxide and temperature in the atmosphere. And I would agree, there is. The problem is, he goes on to say, the increase in carbon dioxide causes the increase in temperature. What if it was the other way around? What if temperature, an increase in temperature, caused an increase in carbon dioxide? That's a good association as well. And there's a good reason to believe that, by the way, because the ocean has carbon dioxide dissolved in it, and when the ocean is warm, it releases carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. When it's cold, it absorbs carbon dioxide. You know this from firsthand experience when you go buy a can of soda pop. In the normal time, when the can of soda pop is in the soda machine, it's cold. You take it out and you open it up, it fizzes just a little bit. But if you have a soda machine or a warm bottle of soda and you open it up, it fizzes a lot. The reason is the carbon dioxide that's in the soda, when it's hot, has to get out really quickly. In the ocean, the same thing. When the ocean is warm, then it's going to release carbon dioxide. And that's probably what the association is here. Next slide. Here's a graph that would argue against Al Gore's interpretation that it's the carbon dioxide causing the global warming. This is a similar plot, but just over that short period of time in the previous graphs from the last 20,000 years, which I, by the way, don't believe in those periods of time, but the data is interpreted that way in the conventional scientific community. I believe the world's been around here about 6,000 to 10,000 years, but I use the same data, and because I'm looking at their data, I have to use their time periods, but I don't believe the time. But you'll notice something here. On here is methane plot, carbon dioxide plot, and temperature in the Antarctic plot. And you'll notice as you go from the past to the current present, this is about 10,000 years ago, so time is moving this way, you'll notice that here you got the temperature going along and then suddenly starts going up rather dramatically. Carbon dioxide goes along and it goes about 800 years longer before it starts going up. That's the kind of trend you would expect if the temperature is causing the carbon dioxide to increase. The increase in temperature occurs before the carbon dioxide with a period of about 800 years. You have other features in the plot that does the same thing. So I believe there's a really good argument to say that the temperature is causing the increase in carbon dioxide, not the other way around. Next slide. Here's what you would expect to happen if you have carbon dioxide increasing according to use. Coal, oil, and gas, this is the world hydrocarbon use, particularly from 1940 on, all those are increasing dramatically. But during this period here, you actually have a the blue is the temperature, and the red is what's called solar activity. That plot you've seen before where from 1940 to 1970, the temperature decreased and then started going up again. That doesn't match the plot of the use of hydrocarbons and the likely release of carbon dioxide. But it does match something else. The red line is solar activity. As the sun gets active, as it increases in activity, the temperature appears to go up, and as the sun decreases in activity, the temperature goes down. That was one of the first hints that there may be some connection between temperature in the atmosphere and the sun's activity. Actually, the first one was, we know that back around 1600 or thereabouts, there was a period of time when the sun was very inactive, and it was by the number of sunspots. The number of sunspots on the sun tells you partly how active the sun is. There was a period of 70 years in which there was no sunspots at all, and that was right in the middle of what we call the Little Ice Age. So people had a suspicion for some time that the cooling and warming on the Earth was due to solar activity, particularly sunspots. Next slide. Here's sunspots on the sun. You've probably seen them. You can actually look through, take a telescope and let the sun shine through it and shine on a piece of white paper, and you can actually see the sunspots on the sun. Don't look through the telescope at the sun, though. That'll burn your eyeball. Make sure it just shines onto a piece of paper. Okay, next slide. Here's a graph of the actual sunspots, the number of them with time, from back 1750 up to 2000. They have an 11-year period, and actually one of these next to each other is reversed, so there's a total period of 22 years of a solar activity, and it just varies up and down over those 22-year cycles. Next slide. Here's a longer period going all the way back to 1600, and that period I call the Maunder Minimum, where there was no sunspots, is when you had the little ice age. And since that time, the number of sunspots has been increased. It varies quite a bit, up to about 2000, and it's been on its way down now. And if, in fact, the sun is what's causing the global warming, if we have less activity, then we're likely to start cooling. In fact, there's some indications already in some measurements that the atmosphere has already started to cool. Next slide. Now, here's a theory that was developed by a fellow by the name Svendsmark from Denmark about 15 years ago. And this is the best model that has been developed and may well be the explanation of global warming. He said that in the past, we thought that the sun's activity may have increased and decreased, and the amount of energy put out by the sun would increase and decrease. But it turns out that change is far less than 0.1%. It's not enough to explain global warming. But Svendsmark said, no, something else is going on. It turns out that the sun, when it's not active, and here you don't see any sunspots on it, it puts out solar flares and it puts out other energy and electromagnetic field around the sun. But when it's not very active, that's very close to the sun, and the Earth, which is a long ways away from the sun, is not influenced by the sun's activity. And there can be cosmic rays coming from outer space interacting with the atmosphere on Earth. And that will produce more clouds. When you have more clouds, it reflects the radiation, the direct radiation from the sun back to space, and the Earth is cool. Next slide. If the sun gets active with sunspots and all kinds of other activity, it can affect way out beyond the sun and kind of engulf the Earth and prevent these cosmic rays coming from space entering the Earth's atmosphere. And when that happens, you have fewer clouds, because there's fewer cosmic radiation, fewer cosmic rays to produce clouds, and that allows the sun to come through more directly because there's fewer clouds and will cause the Earth to be warm. Well, that is a theory right now, and it's only beginning to be proven. One thing that had to happen was to find out whether cosmic rays would produce more clouds. And there's been an experiment going on for the last 5 years, setting it up and actually doing the experiment at a nuclear facility in Switzerland, next slide, run by a fellow by the name of Jasper Kirkby. And he has developed a cloud particle chamber at the laboratory to see what cosmic rays would do when they come in to produce more clouds. And it's based on the idea of something called a Wilson cloud chamber. This is like a piston inside of here. It's that big around. And this is a glass plate. Inside there are gases, the normal atmospheric gases, including carbon dioxide and water vapor. And when this piston is dropped down suddenly, there's an adiabatic expansion causing cooling so that the air is supersaturated in there with respect to water vapor. So when a cosmic particle comes through the chamber, it leaves a trail, kind of like when an airplane goes by, it leaves a contrail. A cosmic particle will leave little particles of water vapor. Next slide. And here's what the kind of images that are left. These little trails are cloud condensation nuclei producing little bitty clouds. And the idea is, if these cosmic rays produce that and they interact our atmosphere, will those particles grow into bigger clouds and make more clouds over the whole Earth, changing the ability for the sun to warm and cool the Earth? Next picture. This is Jasper Kirkby inside of this giant cloud chamber he built. This is the largest cloud chamber on the Earth, except possibly some that the Russians made 20 or 30 years ago. But it's in Switzerland in the CERN laboratory, C-E-R-N, and they finished their first experiments in December this last year, and very preliminary results indicate that, yes, that is an explanation, that the cosmic rays do produce clouds, and that may well be the proof of the theory. It hasn't been finally published yet in the literature, but they're getting very close. Next slide. Okay, now, so what? What are the implications for Christians? We need to understand what's going on here. The carbon dioxide may partially contribute to a little bit of the global warming, but most of it may be not even under our control. It may be completely from the sun. So if we get that answer, then we may have less concern about our atmosphere being unstable and possibly leading to incredible warming or possibly another ice age. So we can be more confident in the life that we're living. That doesn't mean it's an excuse for releasing pollution and so on, because God has given us guidelines. He said, for example, in Genesis 8:22, the earth will be normal as long as the earth is here. It says, while the earth remaineth, seed time and harvest, and cold and heat, and summer and winter, and day and night shall not cease. Another interesting thing about this is I don't believe global warming, the small amount that we observe and whatever happens, I don't believe that that is an immediate sign that the Lord's about to return any moment. So we don't need to get overly concerned about this as a precursor to the judgment by fire. Now, it is coming soon, I think, but I don't believe this is necessarily associated with it. Next slide. Okay, there's some more guidance here that gives us in Genesis 1:27. I said Genesis 1:26 a while ago. I should have said Genesis 1:27. This is part of the dominion mandate. We are to be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it. Now, the question is, what does subdue mean? How aggressive do we get in terms of using the earth? At the same time, Genesis 9:15, after the Genesis flood, God gave us a promise with the rainbow that said, the water shall no more become a flood to destroy all flesh. But when we go to Revelation in the future, we know that we will be judged by fire in the future. So this helps to stabilize us, I think. You know, our whole society right now is very unstable because of the economy, because of global warming, all these kind of things. We as Christians need to be more confident that the Lord is going to take care of us. He has provided this world for us. He loves us, and he's given us all kinds of promises. We don't need to be overly concerned that we have destroyed the earth simply because of burning too much fossil fuels. So I hope this has been a bit of a help to you. I think the last slide. Oh, yeah, I've got a list of conclusions here to summarize this with. First of all, global warming has been occurring for at least the last 50 years, and I think longer than that, maybe 150 years, that's measurable. This warming may only be a short-term fluctuation. There's probably a lot of natural variability in there as well. However, this warming is probably a longer-term trend. Evidence is still inconclusive that the recent changes are caused by man, and I'm beginning to suspect that we're not producing that much of an effect. There are no natural causes for recent warming that have been confirmed, but this new theory that galactic cosmic radiation modulated by solar activity affects low cloud cover and global warming, I believe, shows great promise, and it may well be the explanation. Now, that's not politically correct, but I think that that's what's happening, and it should give us more confidence that God loves us. Okay, that was a fast. You feel like you've been standing in front of a fire hydrant? Sorry about that. It's a very technical talk, but Lloyd told me he wanted to hear it. So, why don't you stand with me, and we'll have a word of prayer, and then we'll sing your special song as you go out. And by the way, I'll stay down front here and be glad to answer some more questions if you have any individual. I was going to open it up for questions in more broad terms, but I ran a little long, so we'll just leave it to talking to you individually. Father, we thank you for this creation. We thank you even as we prayed this or sang the songs this morning about your love and the creation that you provided for us. Father, we just look around us and we see the beauty of what you've done. And yet this is beauty that's happened after that is here even after the Genesis flood that destroyed everything on the surface of the earth. Father, if this world is this beautiful after your judgment, what will it be like when we get to heaven? Father, we pray that you'd give us wisdom, help us to be a good testimony and a good witness to our friends and neighbors who are struggling with knowing what to do, not just in the area of economics, but in the area of global warming. Help us to be sweet and stable and provide assurance for people. And if they wonder at how we're able to live in this kind of a uncertain world, how they might be able to as well, and we'd be able to give them a testimony of who Christ is and what he's done for us. Thank you for this morning. We ask you to bless our time together now as we go out. In Jesus' name, amen.